In the era of Me Too, it might be easy to assume that feminism is having its day, but not so fast. In a recent survey of young people between the ages of 18 and 34, less than 20% self-identified as feminist. Less than 20%, no matter what race or ethnic group they belong to. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, what feminism means and doesn't mean to young people. Call 816-235-2888 to talk about it. We want to hear from you, whether you are one of those young people or if you have observations from the other side of 34. 816-235-2888. We'll hear people's stories in a minute, but first, we've got Kathy J. Cohen with us from the University of Chicago. She conducted this survey. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning.
So this finding is interesting. It's really not just that young people don't identify with the feminist label. There's this interesting twist. Even though very few of them call themselves feminists, most respondents say they are in favor of gender equality. What's the distinction there?
Well, I think what they're saying is they support kind of equal opportunity and a kind of policy agenda that would support the kind of mobilization and recognition of women as equals, but they're just not willing to take on the label or the title of feminism. So if we look at something like equal pay, overwhelmingly across race and ethnicity and gender, millennials believe in equal pay for equal work. They believe and support family paid leave. They believe, for example, that employers or the government or healthcare, someone, should cover the cost of contraception for women. And they believe that we should require employers or the government to cover the cost of quality childcare. So if you think about a kind of policy agenda for feminism, they're on board. They kind of pull the brakes when we say, do you identify as a feminist?
So it's, in many ways, what we're talking about is an identity issue.
Yes. And I think there's some nuance that sometimes gets lost. So when we say, do you identify as a feminist? You're right. About 20% or less say yes to that. But then when we give them the option of saying, I don't identify as a feminist, but I support, and we usually say, or they say, traditional feminist, right? So I think that's important.
Yeah.
So they say, I don't identify as a traditional feminist, but I support women's rights and equality. And when we allow them to choose that option, over 60% of young people say yes to that, except for young whites.
Except for young whites?
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Well, you know, it varies here. About still a majority, but generally young whites, and in particular white male millennials, are the least likely, and might not be surprising to listeners, to identify as a feminist, to support some of the kind of policy recommendations I just outlined earlier. Again, I'm not saying that majorities don't support it. I'm saying that while, for example, 80% of young people of color might support favoring employers or the government to cover the costs of childcare, right, closer to 65% of young whites support that. So there's a substantial difference of about 15 percentage points, but again, still a majority.
So this gets at the larger project this is a part of, Gen Forward, which seems kind of meant to parse out how race plays into the way millennials see themselves and their world. Are you... Can you explain that?
Sure. So one of the things that we've been paying attention to is there are lots of ways in which, you know, people show up in the world, are visible, and hopefully get recognized. Sometimes it happens when we go to the polls. Sometimes it happens when we go out to the streets. But increasingly it also happens in public opinion polls, believe it or not, because of the media. Thank you very much. You know, we are often asking Americans, what do you think of these things? But usually those polls don't include significant numbers of young people, and especially young people of color. And that's what Gen Forward is meant to correct for. We do something we call oversampling African American, Latinx, and Asian American millennials. And we want to understand how millennials think, but really we want to disaggregate by race and ethnicity because it's such an important part of this generation. Millennials are now the largest generation, larger than baby boomers. They comprise the largest share of the workforce. And they're also the most diverse generation we've ever seen. And so it seemed to us important to really pay attention to young people and young people of color when we're kind of thinking about policies that are going to drive the country.
So aside from this detail about the white group and particularly the white male group, were you pretty surprised to see the level of agreement across racial identities on this issue of feminism?
Well, I was surprised to see the level of agreement in terms of policies, you know. I was, as someone, as you say, on the other side of 34 who identifies as a black feminist, you know, I was a little dismayed at the small numbers of young people and also young women who identify as a feminist. But I think clearly there's work to do in terms of political organizing and raising people's consciousness. But if we're worried about kind of policies and a generation supporting what might be considered to be more progressive or equitable policies, I think that's already in place. And I think, you know, that's the good news in this survey.
In what respect do you think race seems to matter when it comes to young people's experiences of gender and how it affects their lives? Within these larger findings, are there details where you'd say, like, on this, you see a difference?
Yeah. So let's just stay with feminism for a minute. We ask a follow-up question, and we ask three follow-up questions about feminism, which is, does the feminist movement improve the lives of, one, white women, two, women of color, and three, poor women? And what we found was, overwhelmingly, again, across race and ethnicity, young people believe that the feminist movement has done a great deal or a lot or some to improve the lives of white women. Now, when we ask about women of color, it's almost less than a majority, in particular for African-American young people. So they say, the feminist movement has done a lot to improve the lives of white women, but less the lives of women of color. And less than a majority of any group believes that the feminist movement has done a lot or even some to improve the lives of poor women. So I think even in these questions, what we see is young people providing both a class and racial analysis, maybe what we call an intersectional feminism, to their answers to say, look, you know, there are differences in terms of the impact of feminism and who has access to, for example, all the policies we support, or even something like Roe and the right to choose. And really, they're, I think, hopefully asking for the feminist movement and feminists to take note of this and to kind of broaden the impact of our work to include more marginal communities in terms of a feminist agenda.
You know, just a moment ago, you mentioned that you are coming at this from the position of being a black feminist on the other side of 34. And
yes.
I'm curious about, you know, with all of these critiques relating to racial privilege and class privilege in the accomplishments of feminism so far, where are you on that? Do you think you see this in some way differently than a younger person of color might?
I think it's complicated, right? In the sense of, you know, the first thing I would say is we've got to figure out which feminism we're talking about. If we're talking about a black feminism that has always been rooted in what, you know, we call an intersectional analysis, meaning that we understand that what you get and your opportunities are not just defined by gender, but also by race and also by class, then I think it makes sense that they would say, wow, you know, feminism has benefited largely white women and at times women of color, but even less so poor women. And again, in moving forward, there has to be a different way of thinking about feminism and a feminist agenda. I think we see some of that already in, for example, the movement for Black Lives or Black Lives Matter movement, where we see young black queer women articulating a feminist agenda that's meant to benefit everyone, in particular working class and poor black people, right?
How
so I think that's a new version of feminism that might appeal to these young people.
Can you explain how feminism has maybe had blind spots for the people you're describing?
Sure. I think if you say what we want is equal access to jobs so that the most, the person with the greatest skills, you know, so there's equal consideration in terms of skill level, but you don't understand that because a person of color lives in certain neighborhoods, they don't have access to educational opportunities that would give them that skill level, then you have a kind of surface level of opportunity and, you know, gender, I think, without an intersection or understanding the ways in which race and class impact one's gender positioning, that doesn't speak to the broader sense of feminism. Another example might be if we fight for choice, right, reproductive choice, and we access or have the right to choose.
Oh, dear. We just lost our guest. Something happened with our connection, just a technological glitch. Hopefully we'll be able to pick back up with that, but for now, let's just continue with the conversation we've been having because we've got a full panel right here in the studio. J. Marie Hill is with us now. J. Marie is an activist and educator around issues facing the transgender community. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, first of all, what are you hearing in what Kathy Cohen at the University of Chicago was just describing?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. Good morning. I think Dr. Cohen is, number one, a mentor of mine and a brilliant scholar. So I appreciate and am honored to be on the show with her. And I think what she's saying is, yeah, like feminism initially was this broad idea that we all needed to kind of fight back against some very broad societal forces, right? Namely patriarchy that we're still fighting. But I think because it initially was so broad, often they weren't specific about who they were fighting for outside of the general group of women. And as Dr. Cohen mentioned, not all women or not all bodies who experience the world as women like are treated the same. And run into the same issues. So for me, as a person who experiences the world not just as a woman, but has experienced the world at times as that, I'm very clear that there are things that both, for me specifically, Black women is who I've tried to focus on, and Black trans folks, there are things that overlap there, right? That I could say, well, I don't want, you know, 50% of trans folks have been sexually assaulted during their lifetime, and that's the numbers are very similar for Black women. And so just thinking about how we can really disaggregate these things to say, well, what could we be fighting together that actually affects us both?
So can you back up a little bit and tell us more about your own personal experience and where you're coming at this from?
Yeah. So as a Black person who experienced, like, obviously people can probably tell from my voice, even though it's a little bit raspy from talking a lot, my voice is generally lower. And as a person who just was athletic growing up and was raised as a girl, assigned woman at birth, there's just a lot of experiences on a daily basis that I have that counter that. They don't invalidate it, but they counter it. And so I'm forced to hold the realities of the ways people come at women, but also I receive the privilege that men receive often, you know, because of my voice, because of how I stand, how I was raised to talk in certain ways. Some of that comes from being, at that time, the only Black woman in a white school or at a university setting, but I just find that I can't separate the battles, partly because they exist in my body, and I know that I'm not the only one who experiences that nuance inside of what we may know of as feminism.
So you live in St. Louis, but you're in Kansas City for a while. Talk about what brings you here.
Oh, sure. So I do work at the intersection, as I said, of these groups, and one main reason I'm here is because I work with the ACLU. We have a new program called the Transgender Education and Advocacy Program, and it's a statewide organizer like position, essentially. So I have to travel all over to make sure folks know that this is a program that they should know about, that there's, you know, because it's still illegal or it's still legal to fire a trans person or anybody on behalf of what you think about their gender. They don't even have to really be queer or trans. But if they don't fall in line in a certain way, the fact that it's legal to fire someone, I think that is, you know, the main work that we're working on, trying to pass MONA, the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act. But part of my work is really to demystify the cultural piece, right? We don't really talk about trans folks except when we're talking about the LGBT community. When the reality is the transgender kind of topic is actually about gender, and we all have a gender. We all have a way that we've been socialized to think of gender, to think that we have to be a certain way if we're a woman or be a certain way if we're a man. And I think trans folks, and specifically gender non-conforming folks, people like myself, who you just can't always tell, or there's hormones involved and people are kind of in between, my goal as a cultural worker is to kind of safeguard that in-between space and let us be trans in public, not just in LGBT spaces or other things like that, because that influences the ability for us to make ourselves safe, right? If we can't get a job, if we get kicked out of a job, we're not safe. And that isn't just about being queer. That's about being able to make a living.
So what would an inclusive feminism look like to you, and does it exist?
It's such a broad question. I mean, part of what I think about feminism, right, is that it was when it first came up, right, it was a signifier of a politic, right? Much like queer or gay and lesbian, like, and when those were first in the mainstream, those were needed for a very specific type of media and like societal pushback, right? And now I think most people have thought of feminism as something that you kind of carry with you. It's not necessarily something that you lead with, but it is something you believe in. And so an inclusive feminism for me is something where people carry it with them, that we should include all folks and that we really need to center the folks who actually have been on the edges. So people like trans folks, even Black women specifically, getting more and more specific with who we are looking out for and who we're accountable to. That to me looks like, you know, going to different meetings, being mindful of where you buy things from. Like, there's just a lot of ways that the media you consume, right? Having people on shows, right, who are holding different identities and bringing different thoughts. So I think inclusive feminism is an ongoing project that we all actually, you know, just like when you sit down and make your goals for the week, you could be thinking about how can I be mindful of the communities that I may not be in, but I really want to lift up as I do my everyday work.
Have you had experiences where you have felt like feminism hasn't included you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think when it comes to me, like, I would say I'm not so much the standard, you know, I'm not this new, like, lift me up or else, right? I'm more so I'm saying I know this privilege that I have around masculinity that I didn't ask for, but is part of where I live comfortably. And I know that someone who has masculinity in their body or perceived, but is trying to live in the world as a woman, like, I'm trying to make sure that things are safe for all of us, because I just receive similar but different kind of oppressions and things like attacks on my character, attacks on my body. So it's not so much about me personally, although, yeah, like, when I look at the Women's March stage, I'm not like, ooh, I really want to go to that necessarily. Sometimes some cities did a great job, and I think the National March really tried to do their best to bring all voices to the table. But
what was the difference between the ones that did a great job and the ones that didn't?
Probably community relationships, really. You know, for people, like, the Women's March in some ways was like a reaction, right? It was both a stand, but also a reaction to something that we thought was going to happen that went differently than we thought. And so when you're reacting out of that space, you may not have time to,
as, like, in Hillary Clinton not winning.
Right. I think for a lot of folks, that's where it came from. Maybe year two might have been a different force. But when we think about the Women's March, I think we're usually talking about the first year. And it was like really reactionary. And so I think the Women's March as a movement is growing to try and include voices in a long-term way. But because many, many people felt the push to become a part of the movement or activism, that meant that it was people who had been on the sidelines and they didn't have those relationships as much as those of us who kind of do this work every day.
How old are you?
29.
So you fit totally in this demographic that we're talking about. Do you self-identify as a feminist?
Much like Dr. Cohen, I actually say if I have to pick a word inside that lineage, I would say Black feminism, particularly because Black women have always tried to make room for queer folks as much as possible, because there's a lot of times, like Dr. Cohen said, there's Black queer women at the front of different fights. And so there's a lot of nuance that Black feminism has that I would say like regular or mainstream third wave, all the different waves don't necessarily allude to as well.
So let's bring back Dr. Kathy Cohen, who we sadly lost due to the whims of technology. Kathy, welcome back.
Thank you.
So
good to be back.
I don't know how much of this conversation with J. Murray Hill you've been able to hear, but yes. Does this sort of reinforce your findings in this study?
Yeah. I mean, J. Murray is brilliant and wonderful and bold, and so very much they represent, I think, the complexity that can be found in this work, which is, you know, as they just said, an understanding that there are kind of traditional or mainstream understandings of feminism, but there are also more radical forms of feminism that are more inclusive, that have a different type of power analysis, that have an analysis of capitalism. I would argue that Black feminism has been an example of that. And so, you know, I think we want to take the numbers and say, okay, we know that a lot of young people don't identify as feminists, but what are the politics that they are espousing when they talk about policies? How do they, you know, line up with other groups in terms of understanding inclusive and broad, the possibility of an inclusive and broad movement? So I don't want us just to stick with, oh my God, they don't identify as feminists, but more to be thinking about what are their politics and what are the political agendas that we can move given their politics.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the knee-jerk reaction could be, oh, this generation doesn't, like, it isn't carrying on the fight, when quite possibly it's that they're taking the fight to another level.
Right, and I think with a different understanding. Now, I don't want to lose feminism, and I think we should say, well, why don't they identify as feminists? I think part of that has to do with the pretty kind of flat understanding of feminism most people have. They don't understand the complexities of different types of feminism. I think there's also the sense that this is a generation, and I hate this talk, but that has grown up with the understanding, for example, that role is guaranteed. This is a generation that's grown up where same-sex marriage was legalized. This is a generation that is beginning to understand kind of trans identity, and it's moving into the forefront of how we understand kind of movements for liberation. So I think this is a different generational experience that might suggest that, huh, feminism, that framework is one of the past, and they might say, identify as queer, which is a more radical politics than feminism. So, you know, again, I think we have to understand why some of these young people would say, I don't identify as feminist, and focus on what is driving their politics at this moment.
Kathy J. Cohen, with us from the University of Chicago, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can call 816-235-2888 with your perspective. Do it now. In just a minute, we'll be hearing from you and hearing from some local people in studio on feminism. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we want to hear from some of you at 816-235-2888 with your perspective on feminism, the label itself, and the larger ideas it either does or doesn't represent. 816-235-2888. And do it fast because we just have a short time left for our conversation. We've been talking about a recent survey out of the University of Chicago showing that across different races and ethnic groups, people under 34 mostly don't identify as a traditional feminist, even though they mostly do believe in gender equality, especially on a policy level. We spoke with a national expert, and now we're going to hear from some local women, starting with Taylor Hirth, a 33-year-old who does identify as a feminist. Hi, Taylor.
Hi.
So can you tell me the story of your journey to feminism?
Oh, boy. My activism in feminism really started back when I was in college. I took an internship with Planned Parenthood, where I was trying to get people involved in I was doing a lot of tabling, and I was also getting signatures and stuff for sex education, various birth control legislation that was going through the House at the time.
What brought you to that point? Because that seems to me that you've already had a journey to feminism before you maybe are doing some of this stuff.
Not really, to be honest. I mean, I started out, I was going to join the military, got really involved in politics at the time, and Obama was elected to office, and so I decided I was going to major in politics instead, and that I found myself at Planned Parenthood.
So what was it that made you, when a switch flipped in some way and you said, aha, I am a feminist, what was that about?
It was about realizing that women are still considered second-class citizens. And really trying to find my place in that and figure out what I could do to change it.
So can you give an example of something that made you see things that way, made you see women at being treated as second-class citizens?
I mean, for me personally, my activism really comes from my own experience with sexual assault and sexual harassment, realizing that I couldn't come forward as a victim of sexual harassment because of the way that I would be perceived and the ramifications that it would have against me really drove home that we struggle with really making sure that women are safe in society.
Yeah, you've talked about your experience before on this show and at a local women's march with a very large audience.
Yeah.
What do you think... You know, why do you think it's hard for a woman who's experienced sexual assault to come forward? And I should say it's hard for anyone to come forward. But what do you think are the particularly like gendered sides of that?
I think the biggest thing is that there's so many different dynamics that impact that decision and so many different factors to take into consideration. You've got your community and how they're going to respond. You've got the justice system and how it's going to respond to you as a woman who, you know, we just had Serena Williams who stood up and demanded respect for herself and, you know, was challenged and told she was hysterical and crazy. And it's like, no, she really deserves respect, and she has a right to ask for that. I think women struggle still to demand the respect that we deserve.
And it does make people angry to not be respected.
It does, absolutely, and that's a valid response. So, yeah, it's just trying to parse out, you know, how you can respond publicly and how that's going to impact the ultimate outcome of your decision to come forward as a victim.
Have you ever been uncomfortable with the label feminist for any reason?
No, I've really embraced it. I think because there's so much, I guess, controversy around the label. It's been very co-opted and commercialized lately. But
in what way? Commercialized how?
I mean, you see Beyonce with the big feminist slogan, and then you've got, you know, shirts that say, I am a feminist, and this is what a feminist looks like, and a lot of people profiting off of the, you know, word feminist. And I think it's great. I think it's, you know, really normalizing it. And I think that's important. I think it's less about the label, though, and more about the idea behind it.
Well, I want to hear more from you, but we're going to bring someone in on this now. Shannon Berry is also here. She works in finance in Kansas City and has her own perspective. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
So we've, so far, this conversation been talking to people who talk about feminism and talk about gender a lot. You are, is it fair to say, a regular person in this sense? Like, this
Absolutely.
Isn't your bread and butter day in and day out talking about gender. Can you tell me about your perspective on, first of all, what you've been hearing so far and where you stand on this word feminism?
Yeah, I definitely agree with a lot of the things that we've heard so far. I think very early I had heard the distinction between feminism and womanism by Alice Walker, who really distinguished between a more inclusive version of feminist. The quote that I love is, womanism is to feminism as purple is to lavender. And I do think that's part of being my understanding of feminism because I am a Black woman. And so seeing how those intersectionalities come together and how you can't define one without the other has definitely been my experience in the world.
Tell me more about your experience in the world.
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up in traditional middle-class family, but I was the only Black female in just about every setting of my life. I've gone on and, you know, I would say I have, you know, established a career in a very male-dominated industry, again, being often one of few women in the room and almost always the only Black woman in the room. And so having that experience and walking through life with that lens, I think you interpret feminism differently and more critically. That word in and of itself.
Can you give me an example of a time when you felt critical of what someone was calling feminism and its maybe failure to see your experience?
I mean, I think the fact that, majority of white women voted for Trump is a perfect example of them not understanding, especially, you know, with the language that he used around women, with the way that he treats just about every class of minority, Black, brown, you know, sexuality, just about every class of minority. The fact that there is a different privilege afforded to white women to still support him.
That felt like a betrayal to you.
That felt very much like a betrayal. And so, and just an acknowledgement of an experience I haven't been able to articulate, but that I felt throughout my entire life.
Do you feel like you can take on the word feminism comfortably?
Beyonce has taken on the word feminist. So I think with the knowledge of knowing that it means something maybe more to me, more inclusive to me, that it means something more life-defining to me.
Life-defining how?
In some ways, just by waking up and living my life, I am acting as a feminist. By going into a world, you know, work every day, being the only one, I am acting as a feminist in a way that other people aren't. So that is life-defining, right?
Yeah, that it's a decision you make every step you take all day long.
Yeah.
Where in some ways, we can't take the label off.
right, in a way, right? In some ways, we can't take the label off. It's actually there. The issue is, do we want to fight the media's perception of what they think
exactly.
feminism is? And sometimes, as millennials, I think we want to choose more nuanced words because we've noticed the fight is so much broader than just the initial push or even the lineages, right? We have first wave, third wave, all of these different ones, knowing that that means that the work has been shifting and changing, but we want to stay in the lineage of this work because we know that folks have fought for us to get to this point, and it's our responsibility as millennials to carry it forward.
I just want to say, like, J. Murray Hill, you know, you just mentioned the media, and everyone at this table, like, is nodding, like, yes, exactly. How do you think that the media characterizes feminism?
Sure. I mean, I think we have to definitely, like, disaggregate it, right? Because obviously we are in the media right now. We're making media. We're making content. But I want to say that I think, you know, someone like Beyonce talking about feminism and being, you know, claiming the word feminist does push a certain narrative forward that wasn't there before, right? And so when I say people talk about feminist or feminism in the media, it seems like people bring it, you know, there's many people having these nuanced conversations, but like the image I think many people still have in their heads is the burning bras and the standing outside naked and things that like don't necessarily correspond to their everyday life, even if theoretically it might move some people forward because that's what resistance does. It kind of opens up our minds, but like burning a bra is resistance, right? And it pushes us to think, like, why are they doing that, right?
But
why are they standing
outside
naked?
There's also been this, like, media thing. I guess, like, I'm thinking more like sitcoms and stuff where it's, like, women rolling their eyes and being like, ugh, men, am I right? And that's been some sort of, like, I don't know, like a shorthand for feminism that doesn't actually, there's no depth to it. That's not what feminists are talking about. You know what I'm saying?
I think part of what you were saying earlier, just in terms of the commercialization of it, we on the one hand, like we said, we need people to know or to think it's cool to be a feminist. Like it's an important concept, right? We want people to know that this is something worth fighting for, that women and people who have to experience gender-based oppression do experience the world differently. But the reality is that organizers like us, the goal is for our message to get out there just as wide, for people to think more critically about the lineage that it is of, and really to say, what does it mean to apply this to a politic, to an everyday life, to my policy work and the ways that I vote.
Shannon Barry, you've been trying to say something here.
No, I think that that is true. I also think that feminism goes beyond policy. And I think, you know, to your point that you just made about the media and, you know, the shorthand that we use around that, a lot of that's because there's not a lot of women writers mm-hmm. in the room.
Right.
And representation in different areas is also a feminist act and also should be included in that platform.
Let's hear from Philip in Midtown. Hi, Philip.
Hi there.
You are not the demographic we're talking about right now.
No, I am not. My son is. I'm not a millennial. I'm a 70-year-old plus white straight male, and I am proud and have always been proud to be a feminist. And I think it's a simple idea that women are people. That is not that hard a concept, and it isn't radical. But one of the things that has happened over the years is that there has been a concerted effort by a lot of money, with a lot of money behind it, to make feminism a bad word, that somehow or another it's radical, or without anybody being able to actually disagree with the programs, things like contraception, things like choice, but being somehow making that label bad.
Well, and I just want to say there are people in the world who agree with who disagree with those platforms. Clearly, but
they're not a majority, and they're certainly not a majority even of white women who didn't vote that way, who voted for the most misogynist president we've ever had.
Well,
but part of that is the labeling.
So, but back to this point, I mean, it seems like you're really calling to make the point that the word feminism has been made into a bad word over the years. Does anyone here think there's something to that in the findings of these surveys also?
I definitely do. I think that's one of the reasons that I cling to the word so fiercely is because it starts a conversation and I can, you know, correct people or educate people in some ways when they go, oh, well, that just means that you hate men or that you think women should get special privileges or that sort of thing. And then I can, you know, counter that and argue and debate.
I think also we've seen, numerous times how people marginalize language to marginalize a movement. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So whether that's feminism or Black Lives Matter or, you know, there's loads of examples of by marginalizing the word, you're actually marginalizing the policies and the movement behind it.
Well, you guys, thank you so much. Shannon Berry, Taylor Hirth, J. Marie Hill, I really appreciate all of you being here today and sharing your voices.
Thank you for having us.
Up next, records are being made in Kansas City right in front of people's eyes. It is very cool. More on that in just a second on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been checking in with out-of-town artists on this show who have been immersing themselves in the Kansas City landscape for the Open Spaces Festival. Today, we're going to talk with someone who's been cutting records for people in a downtown storefront that's kind of like a faux record shop right now, but the records he makes are real. You go in, he records you doing whatever, and then he puts the sound on vinyl before your eyes using this crazy contraption we will be hearing about shortly. Ted Reeder of Never Records, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Explain Never Records, like the concept.
So Never Records is an artwork where very simply I go to a city and I set up a record store, which is also an art installation. And then I open my doors to record for free anyone who wants to make a record. It doesn't have to be music. You don't have to be a professional. You can tell a story. I've recorded astronomy lectures. I've recorded skateboarders skating around the store. The idea is that by coming together in a space that's free of the overt sort of professional considerations of, say, money or fame, that you essentially get a community center that's like a almost like a secular church. So if you take money and fame out of the art game, you get this beautiful space.
You know, I stopped in this weekend and you recorded my son, who's 2 years old, singing a song. And I will say that it was a really very profound experience.
Yeah, I, you know, one of the big questions is why vinyl? Is it some sort of hipster pose? And the truth is that vinyl is the only media that I trust. I've said it before. I have a 1917 Victrola that I listen to in my garden without the cloud and without electricity. So this idea that we committed your son's voice to vinyl, it's an object that will be around, hopefully for generations. And you certainly can't say that about digital media, like an MP3. I challenge you to play an MP3 in 100 years.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was something about the timelessness of the medium that made my mind leap forward like that. Can you
talk? Yeah, and it's also...
Oh, go on.
Go ahead. Well, there's also this beautiful transcendental science to it that I think makes it even more beguiling, where all a groove on a record is sound waves etched by a diamond. So when I take people through that process, I'm hoping to kind of re-enchant the world, if only for a second, and allude to all these other possibilities. Like, if a diamond can etch sound into an object, what else happens in our natural world?
Can you very quickly tell the story of the contraption you use?
Yeah, so I had to research what kind of cutter I could use, and I've now taken this thing overseas 4 times. There aren't that many being made currently, and I found this wonderful team of German engineers who have a machine called a vinyl recorder, and they are located in southern Germany, and they won't sell you the machine unless you come to them. So it was kind of this very interesting experience where the instructions were drive 3 hours south of Munich, cross the train tracks in the town of Holy Church, take a right down the dirt road, and we're in the barns at the end of the dirt road, and bring cash. So it was sort of a leap of faith or a pilgrimage, and it was a wonderful experience. They ended up taking care of me for about 2.5 days, and it turns out that the factory or the barn was about 70 kilometers from where my father grew up in Bavaria. So it was kind of a very special experience for me.
Well, so here in Kansas City, you've recorded several people, and I want to hear some of what you've gotten here in town. We're going to start with a guy named Diego calling his mom.
Oye, mamita, te cuento. Estoy acá con un amigo, con Ted, en Kansas City. Ya no estoy en Chicago.
Sí.
¿Te conté que iba a venir a Kansas?
Me dijiste que ibas a ir a otro lado, pero no me acuerdo si fue a Kansas o cansado o a que se ha dado, o no me acuerdo.
So, what's going on here? What's Diego's project? We're going to hear some of the more intentional sound there.
Yeah, so very briefly, Diego Aguirre Fernandez is an artist from Mexico City who came to Never Records on September 3rd to host an internet radio building workshop where we were able to gift three groups in Kansas City the equipment and the online streaming for radio stations, which was amazing, an amazing experience. We share sort of the same social practice in our work. But I wanted Diego to cut a record, and it just turns out that September 7th is the anniversary of the death of his father. So we called family members who were dispersed throughout the globe from Sardinia to Guadalajara, and they each recorded a remembrance of their father and then also sang a song, a lullaby that the father used to sing to them to wake them up in the morning. And we strung all of the voices together and we created this sort of global lullaby. And it's one of my favorite recordings I've done so far out of the dozen that I've done in Kansas City.
Well, let's listen to the very end of that recording where you weave together all these different family members singing this lullaby. It starts with Diego speaking in Spanish. What he's saying here is that he remembers his dad once telling him that death is just a transformation and that it's when you become one with the universe. And now he sees his dad when he looks at the stars.
La muerte no es más que transformación. Y como mi papá dijo alguna vez explicándome qué era la muerte, es cuando te conviertes el uno con el universo. Y así lo recuerdo y así lo quiero. Y así está ahora papá siendo estrellas y luz con el universo. Qué linda es la mañana y el aroma de las flores, despidiendo sus olores antes de volver el alba, despidiendo sus olores antes de volver el alba.
Qué bonita la mañana y el aroma de las flores, despidiendo sus olores antes de romper el alba, despidiendo sus olores.
So you witness some incredible moments, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a lucky artist. I'm a little choked up, sorry.
No, I've gotten chills all morning.
Yeah. I think when I moved to New York in 2004, all of a sudden I had no time or money to do music or art. So this project evolved out of this need to do those things. So I was able to create this space where anything can happen, because that's the beauty of art. And that's why this is not, say, a music project or some sort of pop-up project. Is there's no rules. So to sit with an artist from Mexico calling his family around the world to sing this lullaby, it's just a very special moment.
We're just going to listen to a little bit of this next one. It's a guy named Connor O'Kane. He is Irish and he follows you to all of your outposts. Is that right?
Yeah, he's been to 5 out of the 9 Never Records installations.
So in this song, he is singing about the American West. Is that because he's in Kansas City?
Yeah, so Connor came to Kansas City for the opening weekend of Open Spaces and put on a wonderful performance. Connor is teaches horticulture in Northern Ireland, and he always brings a bottle of homemade wine to the Never Records installations. So we had a party, and we were able to share this elderflower wine he had brought, and then he has a beautiful song about elderflower wine. This particular song is about the Irish migration of the American West, and he dug it out of his vast repertoire, hadn't played it in years, and then he lays down this amazing performance. And again, it's a keeper for sure. I'll listen to this song till the day I die.
Okay, let's listen.
My father was a mountaineer, his fist and not the hammer. He was laid on his feet like a running deer, and he spoke with a Yankee stammer.
With a Yankee stammer. I love hearing this song. I mean, later he's going to sing about buffalo and stuff, but like all in this Irish accent.
Yeah. Connor is one of my favorite musicians and a riveting performer and just a great guy. So to have him travel from Northern Ireland to Kansas City was just amazing. And I think he really enjoyed it too.
You know, I'm wondering if there are any recording sessions left to book in Kansas City.
There are. So it's filling up for sure. And unfortunately, I had to pop back to New York for a family emergency. But I have openings. People can email me at neverrecordskc@gmail. And I will do my best to record as many people as I can.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. I'd like to thank Dan Cameron and Open Spaces for giving me this great opportunity.
Thank you so much. And that's Ted Reeder of Never Records. Before we go, one of our contributors, Libby Hansen, is here to give her weekly top picks for Open Spaces. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Gina.
So what do you think people should be catching right now if they're going to head out to Open Spaces? It's such a big festival. Lots to pick from.
Well, Thursday night, there's Bang on a Can All-Stars and Kansas City Chorale are doing Julia Wolf's Pulitzer Prize-winning anthracite Fields, which I wrote a piece about, and it's up right now on kcur.org, so we won't spend time now talking about it, unless you want to.
I do want to, yes. Tell our listeners what they might be in, what that's all about.
Wolf went, she explored sort of the region that she grew up in with coal mining. And so she wrote this piece that it's for chorus and chamber ensemble, very specific chamber musicians. And then it also has projections that have images of the coal miners and the breaker boys. And she did all this research into the region and the lifestyle and the industry. And it's this really amazing mashup of social commentary and history and the politics of the time. You know, she gets into labor movement issues and just sort of the far-reaching effects of the coal mining industry and the labor movement and just these people's lives. There were a lot of them were immigrants, and they live this very interesting cohesive built a very interesting cohesive community. Because down in the mines, it didn't matter where you were from, you had each other's back. So it's a really powerful, amazing piece. And to be performed here in Kansas City is a really amazing opportunity.
And you've talked about this before, but who are the Bang on a Can All-Stars?
They are the touring musicians of Bang on a Can, which was formed by three composers in the 80s. And it's a festival, and they produce music, and it's just this really big conglomeration of new music. And then so the touring group goes around and they perform the music of the Bang on a Can people, folks. And so they're really amazing new musicians who are doing experimental, interesting things, and they've never been in Kansas City before, so it's really exciting.
And this is Thursday night.
Thursday night at the Folly Theater.
Any other just quick shout outs you want to give for things that you really think people should catch?
Okay, so
super quick.
Super quick. The Mara Garcia Dance, they're performing in the Village Saturday and Sunday at 2. They're doing contemporary indigenous performance, which should be amazing. And then on the UMKC campus, one of my favorite pieces I've seen has been Any Word Except Wait by Brazilian artist Flavio Cerqueira. And it's great.
Libby Hansen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can listen to anything you might have missed on this morning's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. We talked about feminism earlier on, and we heard lots of recordings people have made in Kansas City lately, just a minute ago. kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Sophia Gillespie, and our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.